From the yeehaws
to the yayhoos
and everything in between,
this podcast is for you.
Welcome back. In this episode, we're going to sit down with Ashley Skaggs and talk to her about her program. She's very well known for her contributions to the barrel racing industry in West Virginia Abbey South, but we thought it would be cool to take a deep dive with her into her barrel racing program and with her horses of how she got her success and where she started. We even pick her brain on maintenance and get advice from her. So on this edition of Travel Talk, let's get into it.
We're on our way home from Marnie Lusner Clinic at Crazy Woman, and we had Ashley with us, so we thought it would be a really good time to kind of hear her story and see her experiences with horses and what's kind of led her to the barrel racer that she is today.
See what kind of advice we can get for you guys today. We both have a lot of respect for Ashley and Brian both and their program and what they do, and so we're going to hopefully pull some secrets and tips and tricks out for you guys today. So Ashley, just start out by telling us kind of how you got your start into horses and into barrel racing.
So I got my start into barrel racing because of my family. For those that you don't know, Steve Jugworth is my great-great-uncle. So my mom rode and all three of my aunts, Tanya, Sari, and Tammy, and then my mom is Paula. So Steve had a lot to do with that. He got them into riding and barrel racing, and then it just trickled down to me. Where it all began.
So from day one, you were a barrel racer.
Yes.
When did you start? How old were you?
So I've seen pictures that they have me sitting on a horse as a baby. So, and then they used to tag me along. So when they were showing, the AQHA shows were big at Winfield, and they went to Winfield all the time, and they would tag me along. So, I spent a lot of time at Winfield when I was younger.
How old were you when you started barrel racing? Or started showing even, maybe you didn't start barrel racing.
I feel like I was probably 10 to 12, somewhere in there. Maybe probably around 10.
And
I had a pony that they hauled around for me. I don't know, actually, I can't really remember how much showing I actually did, but I rode this pony around a lot at Winfield. So, and he was the devil.
Pony teach a lot devil. Of lessons.
He taught us a lot of lessons.
And so who was your first barrel horse?
You may remember him, Hamrick. Do you remember? So my family, they bought me, he was a grade gelding, and we called him Casper. Do you remember him?
I don't think so. I don't remember you until Hank.
Okay. So he was just goofy, but he was a lot of fun, and he was something to start on. And then, I can't remember exactly. Maybe I probably played around and started with him for like a year or two. And then my parents bought me Hank from Ken Duckworth, who is Steve's son.
Gotcha.
Ken and Michelle Duckworth.
And how old were you when you got Hank?
I want to say like 12, 13.
Okay, because
that sound about right?
Yes, okay. Because I didn't start showing like with you guys. We were showing like locally at like Holly Gray and not going, and like just once a month or something.
Which we did too. I remember going to those too. I actually remember going to those, especially with Casper.
Right.
We called it Casper. That's so funny when I think about it.
But I didn't start showing with you guys until I was like 14. So that's why Hank's the only horse I think I ever saw you run. So.
Yeah, so she was like my first legit good barrel horse.
She was nice.
That, you know, was probably a lot of money to my parents back then.
Mm-hmm.
taught me a lot. She taught me, sometimes I think back, and I always tell you guys, like, I don't really know a lot of stuff, but sometimes I just have a feel for things. Mm-hmm. And I think she has a lot to do with my feel these days. Like, I learned a lot of feel from her. She was just solid and correct, and she taught me what it was like to do things right and correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she reminded me of Kit Kat. Same run every time.
Yeah.
Gonna take care of you. Like, loved her job.
Yeah.
Like, just one in a million horse. Like, that's who she reminds me of a lot. Kit Kat.
Ken was really quiet with his hands, and so I think that's why she fit me really good from the start. Mm-hmm. Because Ken trained her, and then I feel like I'm really, majority of the time, really quiet with my hands, sometimes too quiet, but I think that's why we just fit each other from the beginning so well.
Yeah.
So moving on from Hank, where did you go from there?
I actually ran her for a good while. She was like my solid mount for
a long time.
A good while. And went up and down the road with her a lot. And I won, I can't remember exactly what year, but I won the NBHA Youth State Championship on her one year. And some things in the District 04 at that time, like the youth championship. And
you ran her up through, like, high school and stuff, right?
Yeah,
because you were running her when you were with Brian, right?
Yes.
Because then Brian was running Treasure Summit.
Yes.
He started running Treasure
Summit. Yes.
Yeah. So you did run her for a long time.
We didn't really have a ton of horses, so she was my mount for a good while.
So was she, like, all you could want? You didn't really need something faster?
I didn't really need anything faster until she started putting some age. I mean, she wasn't old. We actually tried to breed her, and at that time, there really wasn't, of course, there was just no education. Like, nobody knew anything about reproduction. We actually tried to breed her a few times to my Uncle Steve's great stallion, Amadinky Raymond Jr. I mean, I was obsessed with him when I was younger.
Oh, yeah.
And would have loved to have had that cross. We tried like multiple years to breed her to him and were just unsuccessful. And so, but yeah, I was mounted on her for a while until it was just time to move on. And I'm trying to think who. I think that's when Bugs came into the picture.
Yeah, because tell us a little bit about Bugs, because I feel like she's a really integral part of your program.
She is
now.
If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have what I have currently. She was actually Allie Fox's brother's, Travis's horse, and I think at the time either he wasn't really riding as much, and they were wanting to get her leg back up and sell her. And I actually took her to really just ride and help them move her because I never thought that I could afford her.
Right.
So I had her and just rode her and entered her a few times. And I don't think I had entered her a lot. I remember being at Canvas one weekend. It was like a weekend show. Probably over 100 head of horses, and I think I'd entered her in the warm-up class, and then I was like, I think I'm ready to enter in the open, and I ended up going and like adding her onto the open, and we ran towards the end, and I actually went in there and won the class. And then I just remember like walking her down and getting back to the trailer, and Brian and my dad were down there, and they were like arguing about who was going to buy the horse for me. And I didn't even know, like, this was a thing. Like, I was just riding her for somebody, like, you know. So that's how that happened. We ended up purchasing her after that. And I looked back, and I wish I would have had the knowledge and maybe the skill level that I do to this day to be able to ride her to her full potential, because she was super gritty and a big heart and just really fast on her feet. And I don't know if I really did her justice or not. It was maybe here and there, but she was talented. And I always told myself, I don't think I'll ever have anything as nice in my barn as I will ever have anything as nice in my barn as her. I always told myself, you know, she's an own daughter of Alive and Firing, out of an own daughter by Alive and Firing, out of a own daughter of Easy Rolling Jet, I believe. Yep. So I knew she was a nice mare,
but she was hard to ride. Like she was hard to ride. She was a little different style, and
yes.
So I think, you know, yes, she was really nice, but that was something that
I knocked a lot of barrels with her. I knocked a lot of barrels, but if we had a clean run, it was usually really nice.
Yeah, and I feel like towards the end there, you had her figured out, because you did really well with her. I know there a couple summers, and you were keeping barrels up, and shoot, like I said, I remember when Travis had her, and she was so quick-footed, and you could just, I mean,
so athletic.
You could tell she'd be like hard to keep up with. I mean, like you had to be on your game to like not get left behind on her.
Yes.
She was so quick,
yes.
And then especially in her turns, like so quick in her turns, and so yeah, she was really cool. She was fun to watch.
Yes, she was a lot of fun.
And so I know that we could talk all day about some of the cool horses that you've had, and I don't want to skip over them. I want you to mention the ones that's really stuck out to you. But tell us, before we move on from Bugs, like, I know that you said that you never thought that you would have something as nice in your barn as her. What made you decide to breed her and make her the single foundation of your program? What was it about her that...
She had a lot of heart. A lot of heart. And we battled a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but we did have some lameness issues with her. And of course then, like, there really wasn't, I wasn't at that age.
The knowledge
of sports medicine vets, and I can't remember, what's the least, or low ring bone or high ring bone? Which one's the least of the ish problems typically? Anyway, she either had high or low ring bone. I can't remember exactly.
But wasn't like a big enough issue where if you could have kept going with her if you wanted to.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we kept her injected and we figured out what to do, like shoeing wise. And so there were times that like I couldn't haul her because she wasn't sound. But once we figured out how to keep her sound, but then there came a point where I was like, I need to start breeding this mare because she's nice and I need to get babies out of her. So that she never, we retired her basically so we could get babies out of her. We needed to breed her.
Gotcha. And that's proved to be a good choice.
Yes. Well, it's took a lot of years. We only got two babies, but I'm blessed to have them. So
tell us, before we get to your current horses and your success with them, what are some horses that you had along the way that stuck out to you and that have taught you things, and what did you learn from them?
That's kind of a hard question for me. I think I've picked something from all of them, really.
It's a packed question.
I think they all add something to you over time. But I really didn't have any standout horses since Hank or Bugs. I mean, I had some nice horses that were really solid, but nothing that was as nice as them, so to speak.
Yeah.
So,
I guess that would bring us to current time, to the horses that you've had and how you got them. I think that we all best know you for Jagger. So let's talk about him first. What decisions led to getting him on the ground, and specifically basically his sire and who you decided to cross with Bugs with to get Jagger.
For some reason, I have, like, forever been obsessed with Justin Zerfuel. And, that was my dream cross. Like, literally my dream cross. And I just wanted that cross very bad. And it took us a couple tries, but we finally got one on the ground. And
so you knew from the minute that you decided to breed Bugs exactly who you were breeding her
yes,
to.
Yes. Didn't have to think about it. That's what I wanted to do.
That's pretty cool. I know that some people don't have quite that story, so I think it's really cool that you had that vision from the moment that you knew that you were breeding her. So what about him stuck out to you, or how did you come to know him? Did you compete with some of his babies, or did you know?
Just seeing them run, and I just liked their style, and just thought they were all super nice horses, and I was like, I need one of those. I want one of those.
They're huge. They're massive, too, when you see Jonda on those babies, and you know
she's
if she's
so
there.
Little.
Yes. Like, you know, and they're beautiful. Like, you can have a whole, like, pen full of horses, and, like, you're going to know. Like,
they just stick out. Like, they just stuck out.
And I've never been across one that isn't, like, a ball of muscle. It's so athletic.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
they are.
They just are very athletic. I know that we all have one, but I don't think it's because we're partial to him. Even before I had him, one, I thought that they were super nice and super athletic. So, talk about Jagger. How old is he? And tell us a little bit about him.
Jagger is now 8, which me saying that is like, holy crap.
I know.
Where did that go? But, I don't know, just from the moment he hit the ground, he was just cool, funny, just like a lot of personality, but just knew that he was going to be really nice. Or maybe I just envisioned that, I don't know. But he also he cost me $5,000 when he was 4 months old.
So you were hoping he paid you back one
to
day
to save his eyeball. So,
which is now a joke, because
which is, yeah,
now
like,
we tell everybody that he's blind, so nobody makes her offers on him.
Yeah, because she's had some really nice offers, and we would be lying if we hadn't got text messages, you know, our thoughts of what she should do. And even though she knew in the back of her mind he wasn't going anywhere, she wanted us to tell her that too. And
she
so
needed some, like, reassurance that it was the right decision.
We joke and tell her that we're going to tell people he's a piece of crap and that he's blind.
It's crazy.
He kind of is like an asshole in the stall, so.
He is.
I mean, he doesn't bother me, but everybody else is like, oh my god. But yeah, he's blind in one eye and wants to bite you and stuff, so, you know, just keep your distance. Not really. But,
Well, and I think,
but everything was just easy for him from the get-go, and I tell people this all the time, and I think he's gave me life back into barrel racing, because I needed him.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he keeps me going to the barn every day. Like, there's not really a bad day with him unless he tries to kill himself. So.
Yeah, those, and I think when you breed them, and their sentimental value, it means more, and it makes it even more special. And I mean, if you raise them from, like, a yearling or 2-year-old or even a weanling, like, yeah, it is, but there's just something about, I think, having that, choosing, like, you know, the stud and knowing the mom so well and running the mom. And a lot of people don't get that, like, whole, like, full circle
and the
moment.
The emotional investment that you have in them from that process, like, you have investment of money and time and all of those things, and I think that that's really cool too. But, like, the breeding process is not for the faint of heart.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's a lot of ups and downs, and I know you've had a lot of ups and downs with Bugs. And so when you find, I mean, I have to agree with that, but you're just so invested, and it's different, and it's almost like a kid. You're so proud of them. And
no, and all of that is very true, but also, like, I know, I'm really raised. I know them like the back of my hand. I know everything about them. I know their whole health history. I know everything that they've been exposed to. So that means a lot to me. And I know how much time has been spent with them.
That's a really good point. That's something that I don't ever really sit around and think about. But I'm like so much more comfortable around the one I did raise versus the ones I didn't.
Yes. You just know them like the back of your hand, basically. Especially if you're spending time with them. If you're spending time with your horses, you know them.
Yeah. So talk about Jagger and his younger years of when you first started him, and where did, what hands did you place him in, and did you do the training yourself, or did you send him somewhere?
Well, the hands that I wanted to place him in, because I was knew he was my dream horse, and I was so scared to mess him up, was, and I wanted Julie Castelli to start him, was my ultimate dream.
Don't we all?
But at that time, Julie had a major injury with her knee and couldn't. And she actually had to have surgery. She had surgery, yeah. She had to have surgery on her knee and everything. Yeah. So I had to suck it up and be like, okay, don't screw this up. Because this is your dreams down the drain if you do. So I ended up starting them myself. And, of course, I reach out to the people that their opinions matter to me on things, and started him. And I actually remember the first time I got to enter him, which just, this goes into the Jagger saga story, was at Raphine in November, of course, because I was waiting until the exact date that I could enter him. And I entered him at a barrel race in November in Raphine, and he did really well. He did. Was just over a second off, which I was like ecstatic with. And I remember on the way home, I was looking at a flyer to a futurity at Circle G at Thanksgiving, and I was like, not that I thought I could go and win a lot of money, but I was like, I think I can actually enter him and be, you know, maybe run a second off. Like, I could do this. I could go enter him. And that Monday or Tuesday, I went to go feed that morning, and he just wasn't moving right in his stall and his hind end, and I just had a complete meltdown and called Dr. Angie Clark, and told her what was going on, and she immediately came out, and he ended up testing positive for anaplasmosis. So that just threw a wrench in things. And And then COVID hit in 2020, so there was that.
Yeah.
But everything happens for a reason, and it's all sorted out, and here we are.
So talk about Jagger's style and how, because I think it's, I think it's, we would be doing him a disservice to not talk about how cool he is and just how effortless he does things and how easy he's been from the beginning.
He, oh, I should mention too, he was actually a crypto too. You know, his,
of course he was.
He had to have surgery because one testicle wouldn't drop. So, oh, let's just add that to the list.
I forgot about that.
I did too.
Yeah, he had to have surgery for that. But no, he's just been, I feel like everything's just been easy for him. And sometimes he probably just makes me look good because everything's easy. And I don't typically have a lot to pick on him about. Like, if I am working on something, he gets it really quick, and then I just walk away from it, and I'm like, well, I don't know what else we're going to do today, bud, but let's go do some long trotting, because I'm not going to pick on you forever about it, because it's just fun, and it is easy.
That's so nice. And he's a little fiery going in the pen, which I always think it's fun to watch you warm him up, because
yes,
he's running sideways or bucking or flinging his head.
He's going to lay one down.
Yeah, you know, the worse he is, the more you should be scared that he's gonna whip you, because he gets worked up before. Not necessarily going in the pen, but even just while he's warming up.
He has to get something out of his system, like, real quick.
Warming up, I mean, really. When you head towards the pen, he's all business. So.
He's like, okay, got that out, let's go.
I've watched him from the very beginning, and I can't say that I've been in every show, but I've probably been at 80% of the shows. I've never seen him do anything silly like that in the pattern.
No.
It's all business when he hits that alleyway.
He really has just been all business, like, from the get-go, like, just confident and easy. And I wish they were all like that.
I think he's a great testament to geldings and that there's nothing wrong with giving them a chance. I side with Trisha Aldridge on that not all the horses you keep have to be fillies. I know it's definitely a good insurance policy when they are, but...
Right. I mean, I wish he would have been a filly.
Yeah.
That's what God sent me, so that's what I took.
Yeah. So, let's talk a little bit about Mona. I think that she's another distinct one that everybody knows right now out of your program.
Mona is a red dragon. But so... athletic. Like, I have never set on something that is athletic. Like, she, to be honest, she's more athletic than Jagger.
So tell us, how old is she?
She doesn't know how to use it completely to herself yet. She is six now. She is six this year. So, yes.
And how's she bred?
She is by Julie Caselli's Rick's Policy.
And also out of books.
Yes.
So more athletic, but still in the training season of things.
Oh, absolutely. She is what we have to continuously work on stuff with her. We have learned that you don't pick at her, and you pick your battles with her. But she's actually, like, there was a point where I did not look forward to riding her at all, because I'm all about making 1%, you know, making progress 1% every day, and there were days I was like, well, this is negative 10% progress, and I'm hitting a brick wall with her, and I actually was like, you know what, I need to step away from her because this isn't doing myself any good or her. And I had actually reached out to Julie and begged Julie. I was like, I don't care if you take her for 2 days.
I just need you to do something.
I need somebody else I just need to step away, and I need your thoughts and opinions on this. And thankfully, she took her for, like, at least a good 2 weeks or so, and she actually told me, she was like, actually, well, she knows what she's doing. I can tell that you've got her started. And I'm like, do what? Because I feel like I haven't, like, accomplished anything on it. But
it feels good to get that confirmation that you're doing the right thing too from someone like Julie. So
yourself too, is to know when you need to step away.
Yeah,
if
absolutely.
You need some intervention, it's totally okay. And she's a prime example of that. A prime example of just shipping away and learning.
So Mona is she's so nice. I always think it's amazing, like, when Brian comes out and she has made the mistake she's made, how she clocks. She clocks regardless of her mistakes.
Yes,
so
it's crazy.
She is just so athletic.
She's so athletic.
Are there similarities between her and Bugs her and Jagger that Bugs passes on to her babies?
I think they're definitely gritty, and they have a lot of try. Like, they want to try, and they want to go do their jobs.
I can see that. So, what does your program look like currently and in the future? Do you have goals more babies on the ground? What kind of, what are your plans?
Well, if I could find a sugar daddy or win the lottery, I would be, you know, flushing embryos out of the bug's mare because she's 27 now. So, but I do have an own daughter of the money doctor, out of an own daughter of PC Bronson that we have as a brood mare.
Okay.
She actually had an injury and we didn't successfully be able to bring her back. So I have a 3-year-old out of her by Rick's policy. And we are currently hoping to get some more babies out of her. So she is what we have in our current breeding program, and hopefully she keeps us going and gives us a few babies here and there. Not that we can take on a whole bunch, because I wish I was Superwoman, but I'm only one person, so, and I have a full-time job that unfortunately doesn't let me work from home, so.
It takes so much time, even just to take care of them, and I think that's something that people don't think about, is how much time one horse takes or two horse takes, and you ride Brian's horses during the week, and so, you know, that makes it harder on you, because, you know, you can't, it's hard for you to have even two horses for yourself, because then that's three horses to ride, so it makes a big difference. And just working full time and kind of, you know, everything has to revolve around work, unfortunately, or we can't afford them. And
exactly.
It's just tough. And so maybe talk a little bit about, I mean, a lot of people at least have like a significant other or something that helps, even if they work, you know, to have two people instead of one is still better. But just maybe talk a little bit about, I don't know, maybe give people advice on like how you get everything done, kind of by yourself, get the horses ridden. And
which is as good, because I feel like this is kind of what you all wanted to base your podcast on, and I guess a testament of
exactly
a person who barrel races and has
is successful
job and
has goals
and wants to keep learning and be better. But so yeah, so I work full time. I work a minimum of 40 hours a week with a 30-minute commute to work one way. Unfortunately, I can't sling radiation and find breast cancer in my basement, or that's what I'd be doing. So
yep.
FDA will not let me do that. So I unfortunately have to go to work and, you know, so we can eat and feed these horses and et cetera. But I do, of course, when Brian's home, he is very good to help out with the horses, and when he can, he does help me do riding, and we have a lot of chores and property to take care of, and sometimes I find it hard, because I do a lot of grass mowing, which I hate. And it's not that Brian would not do it, it's just I literally try to have as much as possible done when Brian does get home, so we can, like, ride together or
do things
together, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not that he slave drives me, it's definitely not. And I'm not trying to make people, like, feel bad for me, or I'm not bragging on what we do. I just, like, this is what we have to do to make things work, and we do.
Right, yeah, it's
so
tough.
You know, a lot of times this time of the year, I clean stalls before I go to work, so that's one less thing that I have to do when I get home.
Right.
I can put that time towards riding. And a lot of people at work, they're like, oh my gosh, you've already did physical labor before work, and I'm like, yeah, I've already cleaned 4 stalls this morning.
Yeah. So, you have horses, it doesn't matter what time it is.
Helps wake you up.
Yeah. Gets my blood going.
No. So something we, regardless if you guys realize this or not, the goal for this podcast, we've talked about a little bit, is to bring bring out the strength of certain individuals to you guys of the everyday barrel racing life and things that they can talk about. And something that we really respect Ashley for is a lot of her strategy and techniques are self-taught. And I think that that is something that is really cool that we can point out and bring some information out of her on, because not everybody has the resources of a mentor or coach or something like that right at their fingertips. So Ashley, if you can talk to us a little bit about how someone that is self-taught holds themselves accountable. How do you know you're doing the right things, and where do you learn the things that you're teaching yourself?
I often think we were talking about this earlier in the weekend, which I do come from a barrel racing family. Like, my mom was a legit rider. Like, not a lot of people know, but like her, she won, it was either in 85 or 86, or maybe both years, she won the West Virginia Barrel Futurity.
Okay.
Her pictures are actually hanging in the, like, you know how they have all those pictures in the concession stand at Winfield?
Yeah.
From like all the years. Her, she has actually pictures of her.
Okay.
You know, up there.
Very
and
cool.
She was sixth in the world for the junior AQHA in the polls one year. I think it was like in 85, which is like really cool. But to be honest, like, then my mom was naturally like a rider. But everything is not, like, these days it's so tough. Like, we have got barrel racing down to an artwork now. There's so much better ways to do things now. It's not just get on and go run as fast as you can. There's so much involved because it's such a competitive sport now that you have to get down to the nitty gritty to see what's working to win, basically.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the, I think a lot of the training styles have changed too.
Yes,
like
that's
over
what I was
the years
trying
and
to like get to too.
To make
like,
it faster, basically.
Yes. Because you have to, because
every little thing
horses
matters.
Are being bred to even be better now, and we need to be on the same thing with ourselves too, because
well, they
let's
talked
be truthful,
about,
it's tough out there.
And they talked about like back probably around the time your mom was riding
yeah.
and up until 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have a lot of barrel bred barrel horses.
Yes.
And so now we have barrel bred barrel horses, and so I think that makes a big difference in why a lot of that stuff has changed and gotten faster. So where have you learned along the way to do things differently or to tweak things here or there?
Naturally, I'm such an observer, and of course, we have things at our fingertips now with the internet, and I have, you know, watched a lot of videos, and there's a lot of great articles out there now, but I like to watch people, and I like to watch people that make it look easy, because the ones that are making it, like, easy, they're not having to work as much, they're letting their horses be accountable, and they're doing things correctly, so I just like to, like watching people and seeing what they're doing that makes it look so easy, and they're winning. That's what I like to do, really.
Well,
a lot of that, and just listen. Like, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and there's just so much information at our fingertips now. But I do like to observe a lot too.
Tell us the thing that you told me earlier about the horse. Who do you choose to watch?
I like to watch people who, well, that I want to ride like, and I want to be like.
And that you would let them ride your horse.
Yes, yes.
I think that's really good advice. If it's not somebody that you would want or think that could do better with your horse than you can, you probably should pick somebody else to watch. Pick the person that you think that you can ride behind and that you think could do your horse more justice than yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
Another thing that I think that is really cool about you that I've always admired, and I don't know if I've ever actually talked about this, but you are not one to try every little thing and listen to every person. You're very confident in your program and what you do and the things that work for you. And I think sometimes that can be really hard to block out outside noise and to not compare yourselves to everybody's program and what they're doing and what works for them. So
that's
where does that come from? Like, talk about a little bit of how you do that and what you decide works for you. How do you not just try to compete with the next person and do every little thing that they catch on to or are doing?
I think it's because I know that those, a lot of times those are just gimmicks and they're not going to work.
Yeah.
So, and I think I'm a strong believer in muscle memory. Like, we should be, when we do things, we should be asking our horse to do them the same way every time. We should be using our body the same way every time. We should be placing their feet where we want them every single time, over and over. I don't like when people use the word practice. I need to go practice. Or I think it's basically coming down to you need to keep working on your horsemanship. You need to keep your horses sharp, and you need to do the same things over and over the same way and correctly.
That's really good advice.
And if you have to ride by yourself, like a lot of us do, I mean, I ride by myself a lot of times, and I know, like, Ashley rides by herself a lot of times, and, you know, record yourself. Like, if you don't know if you're doing it right, then just set your phone up and record and see if you are. And, you know, I think something that I've ridden for a long time, but I think something that has just really hit me really strong, like, in the last 6 months or something is to be more intentional with, like, what I'm doing. So, like, don't just go out and I feel like my horses don't actually get tuned on very much. They get ridden a lot, but they don't get tuned on. And, like, I don't mean picking on your horse, but I mean, like, intentional movements, intentional things. Like,
yes.
You know, and I am really guilty of not doing that.
I think I need to work on that more, too.
Yeah.
Because I'm very worrisome and afraid to do too much, because I want to keep my horses happy and I want them to keep wanting to do their job. So I always have that in the back of my mind, but I do need to, like you were saying, right, we need to do more of that.
Yeah.
There's a way to still do that and not have to worry about that.
And to both of those points, I think those are both really important points, and I think with any trainer that does tune, they also know how to realize when their horse is starting to get anxious or uncomfortable or feeling consumed. Like, you see so many trainers that they do these repetitive things over and over, and they're tuning over and over, but their horses are calm and cool and collected. Like, we should be able to do that without our horses getting too much anxiety, and if they are, then we're doing something wrong. So.
And I think that comes down to, now that you've said that, it's because they're asking their horses to do things correctly in the same way every time.
So they're not confused.
So when we make a horse confused, that's when they become anxious.
Or when we pick.
Yes.
You don't pick. You ask the horse, you ask the same way every time, and if they get it wrong 20 times, you still ask it the same way 20 times until the horse gets it. And then once they get it, you're done for the day. And then tomorrow you pick up and it will slowly, but you can't change how you're asking, because then your horse is really confused. And so I think just staying really conscious of, like, what you're doing, your body position. I mean, I just really got schooled on my body position this weekend, you know, but I've been talking about this with them before this weekend, just about, you know, how I don't feel like my horse's mind is, like, mentally engaged very often in a lesson. Like, I lope circles and I might make them spin around, but there's no true tuning or there's no true, like, method to, like, what I'm asking him to do. And so I just really think, like, intentional training is, like, something I'm gonna step up this year.
And I honestly think, like, to a certain extent, like, we talk about, yeah, you don't want to pattern your horse to death at home and that type of thing, but I think that there is a fine line that you walk with that. And I think on the one side of it, the more slow work you do, the more confident they get with it, the less anxiety they have when they see that at a show. And I'm slow work, not running them time and time again at home. But also, I think that gives you the opportunity to give them more relief at the barrels. Like, you can, whatever your relief is, whether that's petting their neck and letting them be done, or getting off and loosening their cinch, or giving them a treat, like your type of relief. I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways that this weekend had my mind going of how you could do that.
And Marnie said something, she said that quote the other day. Holly, I looked at you and I was like, that's a good quote. She said, if you are riding by yourself, you have to hold yourself accountable.
Yep.
There's nobody else to hold you accountable.
Yep. And that's you where are riding. So the recording point that you made, Hamrick, is a really good way to do that, because so many times I'm like, I wasn't doing that. And you guys are, Ashley mainly, is like, yeah, you were. And I watched my video and then I'm like, oh, yeah, I was. Or, something like that. So I think videoing yourself, because we were watching them kind of pick at riders this weekend and picking out their weaknesses. And I think a lot of them didn't even realize they were doing it.
You don't. I mean, you get that muscle memory, you know, and that doesn't mean that it's correct, you know, but
just means it's not a conscious thing that you're doing.
And you can do it slow and slow and slow, and then you do it fast and you panic and you automatically just go back to that muscle memory. But that's where, like, repetition is so important, but correct repetition. And that's where, you know, I think holding yourself accountable is so important. But I don't know. I mean, it's tough to compete with the big dogs, because I know, like Marnie said, she rides 10 or 11 hours a day. And that hit me today. Like, I used to ride 5 hours a day, because I used to ride like 5-6 horses a day. And, you know, I mean, so it's not like, I wasn't like, holy crap, I can't believe she rode 10 hours. But my thing is, like, do you know how hard you have to work to beat somebody whenever you work a 9-to-5 and you get to ride an hour a day and she rides 10 hours every day? How much saddle time are you having to make up for? But that makes it so much more important to, like, be intentional with what you're doing and to ride correctly and get your horses confident, because there's no way, if you just haphazardly go in there, you're beating somebody that rides 10 hours a day. It's not going to happen.
And they're riding different horses. And I liked another thing that she said that kind of goes to some of the things that you guys have said, is she was talking about how important leads were and just feel in general, important feel is in your horse. And she said, the only way I can teach a kid feel is saddle time.
Yep.
So I think that
is so true. Yep. Feel is so important. You have to be able to feel when that horse is fading in on you, or that horse is fading out on you. And sometimes you can catch that stuff and you can correct it right now, and it might save your run, or it might save you 2 or 3 tenths. Whereas, you know, your horse is already out here, and, you know, you realistically should have caught it, you know, in here. And I mean, so, but nothing, I don't care what you do, nothing is going to make you better than just getting your butt in the saddle.
Absolutely. Saddle time. And I see, like, Hamrick, like, when she was going through her time and her slow work, her feel came into play. Like, you made some corrections on your own. Like, you picked up that feel and you corrected timber. And they were like, yep, good feel. Like, and that comes from, I truly believe, like, sometimes we're naturally blessed with feel, but learning the feel to the most is spending saddle time.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes I struggle with that, because I do like to put in the work, and when I don't get to put in the work, like, if I put in the work and I go and get my ass handed to me, I'm okay with it.
Me too. Same.
Because I know that I've been doing my homework and I have been putting in the work. And then sometimes, you know, but there are sometimes, like I don't have an indoor arena. Like, we call it our arena, but it's not an arena. It's literally an area that we work up. And if the weather is not on my side, then I don't get to do anything. And then, like, there's sometimes, like, and I have a lot of guilt over this, but, like, I have a household that I have to keep up with. And, like I was saying, I have to mow grass. And, like, some days I have to pick over, oh, my gosh, I better do my laundry, or I'm not going to have any laundry, or I better, like, find my house. But I need to ride my horse, too. And, like, sometimes those are hard decisions for me.
That is a personal
have like me, you know, my husband doesn't ride, so I mean, you know, it's, which he's really like, he doesn't care, and he's like very supportive, and I never get in the house till like 9, you know, but there's also times whenever, you know, you might go somewhere, or they want to go somewhere, you need to do something, and that takes, you know, time from the horses. Yeah. And I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that, like, it just is what it is.
Sometimes I literally have like 3 hours in the evening, and that's it by the time I get home.
Oh,
know?
Yeah.
I just struggle with that because I'm a firm believer in putting in the work. So when I have to skip a beat and not put in the work because I have like adult responsibilities, sometimes it eats at me.
Yeah.
So that's tough, but I guess we have to work through it and figure out how to balance it all.
It's tough being a poor barrel racer that wants to be a good one, you know? Like it just really, really sucks. But and just speaking on that, which I feel like we've kind of gotten off on to a tangent, but I think something else that's really important besides leads is, I know that there are not very many people that understand bits, and I know that bits are like very, like, they're hard, you know, they're hard. There's not a lot of people that know a lot about them, but I think you should really seek people that do, because it's so important that you're using the correct bit. You shouldn't be just haphazardly changing bits on your horse when you don't know what the bit that you're putting on does, because you could be making the problem worse.
I do some research. There's so much resources out there. Like, nobody taught me what the purchase was. Nobody taught me what a snaffle bit was versus leverage or gag and that type of things. Like, I researched.
Or locked or unlocked.
And learned. Yes, like, there's so many things that you can learn online, and there are so many things that you can't as well, but at least know those basics and
there's so
learn
many
what
videos.
You can. There is.
Like, good, like big time trainers that are explaining, like, how this bit works or that bit works or whatever. But I also think, which is where feel comes into play, I'm telling y'all, saddle time and feel, there is, you're never going to get anywhere if you don't have those two things. I don't care what else you do if you don't have that, because I've learned a lot of what I have learned because of feel, because I can put a bit in a horse's mouth and I can feel that it stiffens that horse up, or that horse is more rooty on it, or that horse breaks at the pole more, or I have more lateral flexion, or there's so many things. And so just having feel and having like a little bit of knowledge, you can learn a lot of stuff on your own. I mean, it's a lot of trial and error, and you might be like, oh, that was a bad day, like, but you know, at least you're learning. But I think sometimes people just haphazardly put bits on, and they'll tell you what their problem is, and I'm like, you know, well, my horse is bendy and you've got a draw bit on him, or, you know, whatever.
But
and
you also need to be self-aware, though, when it comes to bits. Like, I can look at a bit and be like, well, that's not going to fit my hand.
Me, too.
Like, so you need to be aware of, like, what probably work on your horse, but you got to be cautious of your hands and how you ride, like, if that's going to come into play in a situation.
And there's nothing wrong with if you don't have the lightest hands in the world.
Yeah.
Bits can compensate for that, and the sooner that you accept that, the better off you are, because I've heard from so many different trainers, like, that they've worked and worked and worked with people that they were mentoring to try to get their hands softer, and it, like, never, they never made much progress with it. So I think that the sooner you realize how heavy or light your hands are and what equipment works well with that, the better off you're going to do. And I think also, like you were saying, you know, one of my favorite quotes and, like, sayings is, you can outwork talent if you put in more time. And so if you're not naturally talented with feel, that's something you can get.
Yeah, you can get better.
It just goes with saddle time.
Yeah, it does, for sure.
So, Ashley, there's a couple more things I want to talk about before we let you go, because I think that there are some important things that you have a lot of information on. One being your program of how you keep your horses fit. I know that's something that's really important to you. And then also maintenance with your horses.
Well, in order to be fit, you got to get your butt in the saddle. So I spend a lot of, which I know you can do a lot of lunging and things like that. And I'm just not one for that. I like to be in the saddle because I'm one for feel. And Holly and I talk a lot about about this. Like, Holly has an awesome eye for things, which I can't see. But if I'm on my horse, I can feel it.
So we all work well together because I can't. I think that I feel something, but because my eyes are so much better, I step off and I make Timmy get on, or one of you guys lunge them around so I can stand still and watch them. So it's really cool that you guys are able to feel that, because I know that's hard for me.
So to me, that's important. That's why I like to be in the saddle, you know, when I'm getting my horse's condition, but I'm also knowing how they feel. And I usually know if something's like, something's not right here. This horse doesn't typically feel like this. But, you know, luckily I have some fields and I do some long trotting and we have some hills and, you know, luckily I have some neighbors who, I don't do hours and hours of trail riding. I'm not that type of person, but I do like to go hit the trails like here and there. And then working on some cardio, like some hit things, like hit drills, I call them. I don't really say I do drills, but I like to do things that like have them like going a little faster than a lope and then bringing them back down, so to speak.
High intense, yes. Very quickly. And
yes,
then,
and like moving their feet.
Well, and that was something, not to interrupt, but I did want to mention this, and I meant to whenever we were talking about doing, like being very intentional with training, is if you're tuning on your horse, like you can still go fast in your work and then slow back down. You're having problems, you can literally just go fast in that area.
Yes.
And then you can sit down and rate that horse back down. And if your horse won't do that, then right there,
it's something you need to work on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how many times did we do that? You know, you can go slow to the barrel and then you can, you know, speed them up around it, or the opposite,
depending on the horse.
Exactly, like what your problem is. So you don't have to run the pattern to fix something going fast. Like, so I just wanted to, when you said
always,
that, it,
I
mentioned it.
I don't know. This has always been, like, one of my, I feel like if you can't do it slow, you cannot do it fast.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, you need to be able to do it slow.
You have to have that muscle memory, and the muscle memory starts with, you know, repetition, slow, slow, slow repetition, and then you just build on it, I feel like.
Yes.
So, in conclusion, saddle time and conditioning and hit exercises and all of those things. So you would never pull a horse out of the field and run it.
No, absolutely not. Like, that would make me throw up.
Same.
For my horse.
And what are those, like, reasonings? Because I think
is
there
somebody
are
gonna
some
pull,
of our
is somebody
going to
pull me out and like make me go run a marathon out of winter?
Right.
Absolutely not. Y'all have to pick me off of the street.
Even a sprint. I couldn't run a sprint, let alone a marathon.
No, I'm pulling something. And I think that that's really, like, a lot of people just kind of are like, oh, that can happen, but it's very rare. Like, I think if you think of yourself, it's really easy to relate. Like, how easy would it be for you to pull something or be extremely sore if they did that to you?
Well, you know, there's a, like, of course, where we live in West Virginia. I live on the western end of Greenbrier County, which gets more snow. So we don't get to ride a lot. I mean, there's probably, I mean, we like to ride, I try to ride up into like December, you know, pretty good. We usually get to, I do like to give my horses a little time off, and then like winter kind of sets in and it's cold and it gets wet and I don't get to do anything. So like, if you just think about like how you feel, like when you start getting back to riding the first few rides, how your body feels, how do you imagine your horse's body has to feel the same way? Like,
right.
When you haven't asked them to use, you know, you haven't used your core in like 6 weeks. They haven't used their core and their muscles in 6 weeks. Like, mm-hmm. I'm sure it feels the same way.
That's a very good point.
Well, and you have to think, I really actually didn't until I started riding young horses. You don't understand like how much muscle your horse actually has to have to like stay collected and around the barrel. And if you don't realize that, then go get on a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even care if it's a really broke 3-year-old. That 3-year-old is not going to be able to hold a collected small circle as well as like a finished horse, whether they're in shape or not. But so even an open horse that is finished, like, They have to have muscle to hold that. Like, that's not natural. They don't collect
strong
in the field.
They have to be strong.
So many so many people, one of our good trainers was actually telling us that she would have clients come and ride, and you'd be surprised how many horses couldn't lope an even small circle around the barrel. And I think that, like, goes into that. Like, if you're not exercising them and riding them, how can you expect to do that? And even if you're not out there to win the world, I mean, you should be trying to do the best you could do.
It's too expensive to
not. Yeah, it's another thing, like, horses can get injured anyway. I mean, like, they try to kill themselves every day. That's what they wake up and do. But I just feel like we're putting them at more of a risk, too, if we're not trying to get their physical condition to par before you go make a competitive run.
And I think, I want to say this, too, and it might step
but on But I pay my own vet bill, so I'm very cautious on
it. Yeah, even though my horses act like they pay them, but they don't.
Right.
But I want to say this, and I'm going to step on people's toes, but I think it needs to be said. I don't care how fast your horse is. I don't care if you have a 40 horse or a 5D horse or a 1D horse or whatever. You know, all of those horses need to be in shape. You can say whatever you want. You can try to justify it however you want. If you haven't ridden in 2 months and you pull your horse out of the field, like, you're not doing a service to your horse. But I think some people get away with that because, yes, I think you should treat. I think you should vet. I think that you should do all the same things for a 4D horse that you do for a 1D horse. So I want to put that out there, and I mean that. When we had Treasure, who was like the 4D queen, she got the same treatment that Breeze did. Like, we treated her exactly the same way we treated Breeze. So I have lived that. I stand by that. But I think sometimes people get away with that because 1D horses and 2D horses especially, they work a little bit harder than a 3D or a 4D horse. They turn faster. Their feet are quicker. And so it's so much easier for those horses to get hurt. And so I think sometimes people, they don't see that. They're like, well, she does it. My friend does it. She hasn't ridden all winter and she pulled her horse out and she does it all the time and they're fine. Okay, well, is your friend running 2 seconds off or is your friend winning the barrel race?
And also, has a vet looked at your friend's horse and said it was good, or does your friend just say that the horse is
that
good?
That makes a big difference, too. Like, is your horse, but it's not crippled, you know, but it's going to be so much easier to cripple a 1D horse than it is a 4D horse.
Yeah.
So I think you have to think about those things as well. Like I said, every horse should be treated the same, and they all work hard. I'm not saying that a 4D horse is lesser, but
we should treat them all the same. They deserve that.
They do deserve that.
And, I mean, what Ashley means by that, and she's reiterated this, but I want to reiterate this, too. Like, she doesn't mean that 3 and 4D horses don't need maintenance.
Or that they don't need exercise
and that they don't need taken care of. But when you're looking at a 1D or 2D horse, which a lot of 3D horses can be.
Could be.
You're looking at the difference of a snap of a finger. Literally. And so, a snap of a finger, injections and air and exercise and all of the things
and
they
nutrition.
Talked about make
nutrition.
A huge difference. And so that's what she means by that. And it does take a lot more to keep them going because
that snap of that finger comes
with a lot of cost.
Yep, they use their body so much more, I think, and they use their body so hard and they turn so much harder and I don't know. So if you're sitting here and you're rolling your eyes because you're like, I've done this forever, I just think maybe people don't think about that. So
I'm an overthinker, so sometimes I think about things way too much, but I don't know. But I'm gonna, you know, and I say this a lot. It's taken me to this point in my life to have the things that I have, and Ron and I both worked really hard, you know, in our careers and on our farm and with our horses, but I never really had, like, and I joke and I tell people, I'm like, I don't know, like, I've never really had a lot of nice things. Like, I have nice things, but when I say nice things, like, I don't have the gimmicks of barrel races. I don't have, I'm just saying that I'm spending money. I've always spent money on my horse's nutrition and vet and maintenance over going and buying a 20 flashy halters or to have 100 pair of splint boots in my trailer or
Or the therapies, like all yes, the therapies, like yeah.
I'll just put those things first. Of course, I want nice things, but like I know that I have. If I'm asking my horses to perform, I just try to put. I've always tried to put their nutrition, and I will, of course, put their nutrition and their maintenance first before I go buy all the flashy ass things that there's out there. Like, that's most important to me.
So that's a perfect segue into tell us about your maintenance. What do you do every year for your horses?
Dental work, of course, deworming. At some point in the year, I run a full, you know, if there's a place where I feel like we went really hard for a month to long weekend shows and my horses are getting, like, I feel like they went through a really stressful period and it, or I'm selling up and they acting a little cinchy and they typically don't act cinchy, I'm going to run a 30-day treatment of ulcer meds. And at some point in the year, I always do that.
Okay.
And then I'm not saying they, I just try to stay on top of those things. And then, of course, we always, I got Angie Clark on my side. Of course, staying on schedule with my farrier, Stephen Belcher, you know, that's important. We don't just, like, pull shoes and turn them out for the winter. Like, they still stay on the schedule. Dr. Ronners is, you know, very awesome with his sports medicine, and that's, I make trips to him. I always like to, even if I don't think I have any major issues, I still go and I let him look them over really well. That usually happens a couple times a year.
So how often do you shoe your horses?
It's probably, you know, it's depending on what time of the year and how much grass, because I feel like if our horses on a lot of grass, are their feet typically grow faster. I don't know. 6 to 7 weeks. You know, okay. I think we're like probably 7 weeks during the winter months. And
six during the summer. Okay. And then you said the performance horse that at least a couple times a year.
Yes.
If you feel something that's off, do you go more often than that?
Absolutely. And then I tag horses along with me, even if I don't think that there's anything wrong, we're going to go make sure since I'm going.
Yep. And do you, if you do feel something, because I think that this is preference and important for people to know too, maybe for our listeners, if you feel something, do you run them and see how they do? Do you immediately stop everything? Like, how do you go about that?
I immediately stop because I just feel like I spend so much saddle time and I know my horses. I know that something is typical. Like, for example, I don't know if y'all remember, like, we went on vacation, like, the 4th of July week, and my horses had a week off, literally, lived their best life, and I come home, you know, from vacation, ready to get back to work, and I get on Jagger, and I'm like, what did this thing do while I was gone? Like, something is wrong with him. And, so, got an appointment with, you know, got an appointment and had a sore SI. Like, you know, I just knew from just, yeah, I mean, like, I don't know why he did it while we were gone. I guess they had a good time, but, you know, it was, like, just even, because I was just out there doing ride work, just trotting around and, like, asking him to go in a lope. And I immediately knew that this, something's not right, like. He's not picking up and going in a lope for me immediately. This isn't him. He typically does not do this.
Yeah.
Well, and I think people want to jump to the given horses like human emotion. And they want to say, well, they're mad at me. Or they're doing that. They're doing that on purpose. Or they're... And that's just such an old way of thinking about things. Like, if your horse always picks up its left lead and then he's refusing to pick up his left lead, it's not because he's being a butthole or because it's because there's something wrong. Like, period. There's a period there. There's not a, well, this, that, whatever. No. If your horse typically does something and they stop doing that, there is something wrong. It may not be lame. Maybe it's got ulcers. Maybe it has, you know, I don't know, God forbid, EPM or Lyme's, or, you know, it's not always... It's not always going to be three-legged lame. Like, I think people need to learn that horses start telling you there's an issue very subtly. And if you will just listen.
I wish I knew 8-10 years ago as well. Like, that's just something.
And I think that's another reason why performance horse vets are important, because they check them from nose to tail. It's not just about their legs. There are so many other things that can be wrong with horses.
Yeah, like, you had a horse, which I've never even heard of, that had, like, a neck issue. Like,
a neck, first rib injury, and then also a pole ligament tear. Like,
I mean, yeah, like, who's ever heard? I mean, you know, it's not always legs. Like, and I am the first to think, like, oh, well, they need injected, or it might be something that's just completely just weird that you've never heard of, but you're not going to know that unless you get it taken care of. And if you've been struggling and you're like, well, my horse isn't really, like, he's not really doing anything, and he's still doing the things I ask him, but he's just not clocking, or he's just not, you know, this, there's still something wrong.
They're confirming that for us. We just have to listen. And then, like I was saying, back to, like, the first day that I got back from vacation and I rode, now I was like, okay, maybe I'm crazy. I haven't been on my horse for a week. I'm going to get back on him today. And I did. And it confirmed it to me. Okay, I'm not crazy. Yes. There is something going wrong with my horse. Like,
so you immediately didn't take him to a barrel race. Do you still ride him at home?
No. Not after that stuff. You know, I got on, I'm like, okay, I'm going to ask him to, like, lope off again. And then, like, he wouldn't pick up his lead. And I was like, nope, I'm done. That just confirmed it for me. Like, there's something going on here. Like,
and that just goes back to feel and knowing your horse, which I think the moral of this story is saddle time.
Yes, indeed.
And then going back to maintenance, oh my goodness, I feel like tick-borne diseases is becoming so prevalent in our area.
It Holly is.
And I were talking about this.
It is. Ticks are evil, like, and we really wish that there was a bigger equine market so they'd come out with a vaccine for those things. Yes. Until then, we're just stuck running minocycline through our horses.
Don't forget to rent. I mean, it's awful, but. And we don't want to, but randomly test your horses for tick-borne diseases.
Yep.
And pay attention to your horses, not just in the saddle, but in the field. Are they at their normal energy level, or do they seem a little blah to you? And it can be anything from parasites to EPM to anything. I mean,
yep.
But if you just know your horse, spending time inside and outside of the saddle, you'll know. Like, there will not be a doubt, and you will know even when a vet doesn't know. And when you know and a vet misses it, go to another vet. And
exactly.
That doesn't mean that person, you know, was the most awful person in the world, but you just know your horse better than what they're seeing at that time. And go until someone finds it, because
And
that has happened so many times for each of us. And
I think, you know, I feel like I'm really blessed with some good vets that listen to me, though.
Yes.
You know that.
That's important.
They know that you know your horse, and they listen to you.
And a vet
that
will watch your run videos, like, if it's not something that is just happening, like, it only is happening at barrel races, and you can't put your finger on it, I think that's really cool, too, because they're, like, watching and understanding how they're moving and that type of thing. So I think that's why it's really important that they see performance horses all the time, because they're familiar with that type of thing.
Thanks for listening to our podcast, where we're not so rich,
not so famous,
but we're all trying to be.